Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. Here I am returning with our good friend George Miller. Hey, George, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing great. And we're here for the fourth and final installment. Is that right?
Man, I hope this is... I've enjoyed doing this, and you've been a great interviewer, but I think...
Yeah, this is sort of a Cecil B. DeMille, you know, epic of Mormon Expression proportions. So it's time for us to move back to our petty little stuff. No, in all seriousness, I've enjoyed the series. I've had a lot of feedback from people that I've met around who have said they've listened to these over and over and over again, and that you've opened a lot of people's eyes. And I think you provided a great service because, you know, this information on Masonry is just not that available. It's not out there.
Yeah, it's not, sadly enough. And hopefully I can get this stuff into print sooner than later. Let me go ahead and answer a question that I've been getting on the boards quite a bit. They've been asking, you know, when are we actually going to see this stuff in print? So I'm actually working in a collaboration right now with Mike Reed to write this stuff up. And you guys have had him on your podcast before talking about Mormonism and the cross.
Yeah, Mike's a brilliant guy.
Oh, he is. And he and I both gave presentations both at the Mormon History Association, then he gave a second one at the Sunstone Symposium on the Christianization of Freemasonry. And we're planning on both publishing, hopefully at the same time, kind of back-to-back papers on the Adamic. I'm going to be publishing on the Adamic language and its Masonic ties, and he's going to publish his paper on the Christianization of Freemasonry. Following that, we're going to have two articles, which we've largely got hashed out, though the writing still needs to be done, on the Book of Abraham. We'll then move to the Book of Moses, and then we're going to write a paper on the Book of Mormon. And so those will be coming out, but probably slowly over the next 3 years. So,
well, I look forward to it. You guys are doing a great service. All right. Well, last episode, we left off in Nauvoo. I think we should pick back up with Joseph Smith. There's a couple of gems that we want to explore there. So let's dive back into Joseph Smith and Masonry and then take it from there.
Okay. So the first thing let's go ahead and go into, we actually know that there's been several things that are reported secondhand that Joseph Smith talked about the relationship between the priesthood and the church and Masonry. And these quotes, for those who study the Mormon Masonic connection, are pretty, you know, most people have heard of them. But sadly enough, amongst most people that deal with them, they deal with them very, very badly. They don't know enough Masonic history to really understand what Joseph Smith is talking about. And so the first one we're going to quote is actually from Heber C. Kimball. And in a letter that he wrote to Parley P. Pratt, he says, "Brother Joseph feels as well as I ever seen him. One reason is he has got a small company that he feels safe in their hands and is not all he can open his bosom and feel safe. I wish you were here as to feel and hear for yourself. We received some precious things from the prophet on the priesthood that could cause your soul to rejoice. I cannot give them to you on paper, for they are not to be written." Now, for a Mason, that jumps out.
Right.
One of the Masonic oaths is, you don't write these things down. It says, "So you must come and get them for yourself. We have organized a lodge here of Masons since we obtained a charter. And that was in March. Since then, there has been 200 been made Masons. Brother Joseph, Sidney were the first that received into the lodge. And all the 12 have become members except for Orson Pratt. He hangs back. He will wake up soon." And then he says, and this is the important line here, "There is similarity of priesthood in Masonry. Brother Joseph says Masonry was taken from the priesthood, but has become degenerated. But many things are perfect. We have a procession on the 24th of June, which is called St. John's Day in the country, and I think it will result in good. The Lord is with us, and we are prospered." So most people have read that they focus in on this idea that that Masonry was taken from the priesthood, but has become degenerated.
Right.
Now, the question here is, if you were a Mason, which obviously Kimball was, and in fact, at that point, most of the Quorum of the Twelve, and slowly all of Nauvoo was becoming Masons, what would that mean to you? Okay. Now, remember we talked a little bit in the past about how Joseph thought of priesthood and Masonry as the same thing. Well, what he's talking about here, what Joseph is worried about, is that in fact the priesthood has been taken from Masonry. Joseph is here clearly alluding to what we've discussed in the past, that at one time in the past, when you go back to the ancient patriarchs like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Enoch and Adam, that at that time they weren't separate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, then he asks this, and then Kimball says, but many things are perfect. And so, you know, that's a pretty good thing to say. But he does have this statement that says the priesthood has become degenerated. Now, the question here is, in what aspect, what is Joseph Smith talking about there? And it turns out we actually know what he's talking about there, because Franklin D. Richards, much later, told us what that meant. This is from Rutger Clausen's journal in 1899, so we're a little bit removed. Franklin D. Richards was in Nauvoo, was made a Mason in Nauvoo. His father was one of the first people in the was one of the guys in the first endowment ceremony. And he says, Joseph the prophet was aware that there were some things in Masonry which had come down from the beginning, and he desired to know what they were, hence the lodge. Masons admitted some keys of knowledge appertaining to Masonry were lost. Joseph inquired of the Lord concerning the matter, and he revealed to the prophet true Masonry as we have it in our temples. Owing to the superior knowledge which Joseph had received, the Masons became jealous and cut off the Mormon lodge. Okay, so he's alluding there to something. These are keys that Masons themselves supposedly admit are lost. That's what's been degenerated. It's not that the ritual's completely different or that Joseph thinks that Masonry is bad. It's that the Masons themselves admit something has been degenerated. And within Masonic lore, when you become a Master Mason, you find out what those keys that were lost were. Now, the way this works is that the kind of the secret, the important secret in early 19th century Masonry, what they thought the key to Masonry, the most important thing was something known as the Master's Word. And this Master's Word was the true name of God. And within Masonry, in the Master Mason's degree, you're actually told that with the death of Hiram Abiff, that was lost. And so what Joseph Smith is the only thing that Joseph Smith views that's problematic with Masonry is that they have lost the true Master's Word, the true pronunciation of the name of God, and second, that the priesthood and Masonry have wandered apart. They're no longer connected. And so that's what Joseph Smith is largely doing in Nauvoo, is first, he's relinking the priesthood with Masonry by having all the priesthood holders become Masons and then take the higher degrees of the endowment, this appendate lodge that he's basically created for Mormons only. And then the other thing that he's restoring is the Master's Word, the Shem HaMefurash, the secret unpronounceable name of God, which actually harkens back way, way back to his New York years with magic. And according to the books that he was reading about magic, the way one had the most powerful ability to talk to God, to receive revelation, and to receive the attributes of God required one to know the true name of God. And so that's what Joseph Smith is claiming to restore to Mormonism and to Masonry.
Okay.
So with that understanding, I think people can start to understand a little bit more of those quotes and what's going on there. And what exactly Joseph Smith means when he says that Masonry is degenerated.
Okay, I can buy that.
Okay. Okay, so let's go ahead and move from there into Joseph Smith's last days. So many Mormons have heard this claim that Joseph Smith gave the Masonic sign of distress just before he died.
Yes. I have to admit that I've always found this argument kind of dubious. So I'm interested to see where you fall. I mean, it could be.
It could be. And I think there is some doubt. The only person that there's only one person that really could have reported this. Okay? Maybe two. And those were the people that were in the jail at the time with Joseph.
Like Willard Richards.
Willard Richards is one of them.
Well, he's the only one who wasn't shot, so.
Yeah. The other one, of course, is John Taylor, who's also in the room at the time. And it is John Taylor that actually makes the claim that Joseph Smith ran to the window, raised his hands, and gave the grand hailing sign of distress. Yeah, and John Taylor became a Mason in Nauvoo. And in fact, it's John Taylor that makes this claim. And just about every Mormon accepts it. In fact, I haven't found a Mormon that doesn't accept it in Joseph Smith's time. John D. Lee accepts it. It's recorded in his journals. Brigham Young accepts it. One of Joseph Smith's wives accepts it. They print it in the newspaper, and nobody, you know, cares. Now, the question here, I think, is really, does this make sense for Joseph? Did he already have a kind of preoccupation with this grand hailing sign of distress? And in fact, he did. We actually know there's reports that a year earlier he had been jailed, and he had actually given the grand hailing sign of distress. There were some Masons there that helped him out legally to get him quickly out of jail and released. And so Joseph Smith has a history of giving this grand hailing sign of distress. Also, if you go back and look in the Egyptian alphabet and the grammar and alphabet of the Egyptian language, there are places there where the grand hailing sign of distress is alluded to.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, there is. In two spots. In fact, it discusses a male and a female both knowing them.
Now, I just realizing we're probably getting ahead of ourselves. Now, okay. There might be a lot of listeners who don't know what we're talking about.
Okay, that's
now,
probably
is this something that you're forbidden from revealing?
Why don't you go ahead and reveal it? It'd be easier that way.
Okay. So let's see. I might flub this up. It's been a long time since I've had to hail a fellow brother. So I'm going to make sure I get the right text here.
Are you looking in Duncan's?
No, I'm just looking up on the internet so I can make sure I get the right text here. Because I don't want it. There it is. Okay, so to make sure everybody understands the grand hailing sign of distress, I believe this was set up so that a Mason who is in distress can call out this and give the sign such that other Masons can rush to his aid. Mm-hmm. And I believe the sign is given by raising both hands towards heaven with each of them at a 90-degree angle, and then they're lowered. In three distinct motions, which of course our LDS friends will recognize. And the words are, "O Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son?"
Mm-hmm. So what Taylor reports is that Joseph Smith runs to the window, sticks his head out, basically, raises his hands above his head, and yells, "Oh, Lord, my God," at which point he's shot from enough to force him to fall out of the window. And then, depending on what reports you read, he's then pushed up against the well right outside of the window there, and then shot by three people. And that's how Joseph Smith dies.
See, and now maybe you can dispel another myth here. See, I always thought it was taught, or it was the fact that he gave the distress signal was important, because the rumor was that the Carthage Greys were sort of organized and pushed through their own Masonic lodge. So this was a further indictment against the Carthage Greys and those who were there to kill him, because here was a Mason, and Joseph Smith gave the sign of distress, and the Masons down there basically betrayed their oaths. So it's sort of that fate of the persecutors mythology, where here they're adding further damnation to their souls by ignoring their Masonic duty.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, John Taylor writes a newspaper piece where he tells this story exactly like you've described it right there.
Okay.
He calls the local Masons to repentance. Now, the truth is there were many Masons within the crowd.
As there would be.
There were many Masons in the area, so it's not a big surprise. And they did not come to his aid. Now, the question here is, you know, how would they have viewed this? By that time, the Nauvoo Lodge had been declared clandestine, meaning they had pulled its charter, making all of the Masons basically illegitimate Masons. And so, in truth, they would have looked at Joseph and said, "Buddy, you're not a Mason anyways." Okay. And so, you know, that I think that would be their feelings about this. Now, let's go ahead and dispel another rumor here.
Okay.
Are the Masons in the crowd killing him because he revealed the signs? No, I really don't think that's the case. You know, they're really worried about much more important things, like the fact that they have put lots and lots of legal battles against Joseph, and every single time they try to call him up to be tried by the law, the city council issues a writ of habeas corpus, and so Joseph Smith basically is immune to the law. And that is what has riled up largely the entire, you know, group in Illinois, is because Joseph has basically become immune to the law. That's why they wanted to put him out of commission, per se.
Right.
Yeah, so I hope we can dispel this myth that, you know, this is some type of Masonic revenge. I don't think that's the case at all. There's no real indication of that. Now, however, amongst the Mormons, they do believe that there's been a conspiracy, a Masonic conspiracy, to take out Joseph. And largely this is because of what happens in the aftermath. There were a few members of the mob that were linked directly to Joseph Smith's death, like a guy by the name of Mark Aldridge, Levi Williams, Thomas C. Sharp, and Jacob C. Davis. And these guys, three of them who were indicted on charges of killing Joseph, returned to their city, and one of them is the Worshipful Master of Warsaw Lodge, Mark Aldridge. The other three are non-Masons, but they apply for membership to the lodge. Now, according to Masonic rules, when you're under any charges, legal charges or indictments or et cetera, you're not allowed to your petition's just supposed to be thrown out. Mm-hmm. And the lodge actually accepts their petition and begins the process of making them Masons. And so it looks like to the Mormons that, you know, these were the guys that killed Joseph, and they're being rewarded by the Masonic Lodge to, you know, for their actions by becoming Masons. And the lodge is in fact going to protect them in similar ways as what we saw back with the Morgan affair. That's the Mormons' interpretation of this. And in fact, Brigham Young, for years after that, would actually claim, was worried about the Masons, and sometimes almost with a little bit of paranoia that, you know, the Masons were going to get him, and there was a secret cabal to take him out.
But doesn't that feed into, you know, the theory you had talked about earlier, you know, with the Book of Mormon stuff, that if the Mormons believe that they had the true, you know, priesthood, and it was kind of one and the same with Masonry, wouldn't there be a tendency to see the corrupt Masonry as sort of, you know, the Master Mahan stuff, the big dark secret? And maybe we'll get to that more when you talk about Salt Lake.
No, and I think that's exactly what we're seeing here. You know, on the last podcast, you mentioned the idea that there's always, you know, this idea of good and evil. And that is, you know, the story we find in Antiquities of Freemasonry. I think it's the story that Joseph Smith in his mind is thinking about. And I think it's that concept made its way into Mormonism. And so they always saw that there would be a good Masonry and a bad Masonry. And when the local Masons, many of which, you know, had been good friends, all of a sudden there's Masons among them that were amongst the crowd that killed Joseph, they make the somewhat logical conclusion may not always be correct, that, you know, this is a reassertion of the spurious branch of Masonry, mm-hmm. that is taking over the Illinois lodges and leading to problems.
Okay.
So, I think you're just seeing this same cycle. So let's talk about one last thing with Joseph Smith's death, and that is a question amongst some historians are like, yeah. Amongst other historians are like, no. And let's talk a little bit about Joseph Smith's Jupiter talisman.
Oh, yes.
Okay. There's been a lot of question whether Joseph Smith, if this was really Joseph Smith's, or if it wasn't. Was it on his body when he died, or wasn't it? What did the Jupiter talisman mean to Joseph? Did it mean anything? And there's been a lot of questions about this. And the interesting thing here is that recorded down through kind of the family line, those that had it, the Jupiter talisman had a specific name. They didn't refer to it as a Jupiter talisman. They didn't refer to it as a magic talisman. They referred to it as Joseph's Masonic Jewel.
Okay.
Now, Quinn looks at this and says, it's not a Masonic Jewel. It has nothing to do with Masonry. And Quinn is partially correct. And partially correct, but he's also missing, I think, a large part of the story here. So we talked a little bit about this before. The Jupiter talisman was created with instructions that came from text written by Henry Cornelius Agrippa, who was himself a Mason, or at least more. Masons of his day believed that Cornelius Agrippa was a very, very prominent Mason that started much of the Masonic branches in France and Europe. And so within the Smith family household, I think they actually thought of these magic and Masonic things as connected. And so they probably looked at this as a Masonic. Now that word jewel is a, in Masonic speak, is the medallion that like a worshipful master will wear in the lodge. And according to Masonic legend, Hiram Abiff had a Masonic jewel on which was carved the Shem HaMefuresh, the Master's Word, the secret name of God, and that when he died, that he threw it in a well, and it wasn't to be recovered until much later. And so the idea here is that he had it on him at his death. Now, there's another thing that's interesting. If you actually look at, actually somebody on the board found this. I'd already known about it, but they actually ran into it themselves, and they posted about it on the Mormon Expressions board. There's a very popular Masonic writer at Joseph Smith's time, which we know Joseph Smith probably knew, because in his discussion of that phrase that we discussed back in episode 2, the faculty of Abrac, Hutchinson describes this faculty of Abrac, and in that discussion, he describes that in ancient days, that one would receive, when one underwent the mysteries, a medallion, which was important, and it had what was connected to the name of God. And it actually describes that medallion as associated with Jupiter Amun, or Jupiter Amon.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have Joseph Smith revealing very early that the name of God is Amun. It's associated with Jupiter, according to the Masonic stuff. Okay, and if you actually look on that Jupiter talisman, it has letters that are secret names of God that are Aleph Beit, or Ab, or Father, which Joseph Smith actually weaves into his ideas on the Adamic language later. And so all of these, the Jupiter talisman, the name of God, all of this stuff is actually tied into the Jupiter talisman. It is both a magic and, at least in Smith's mind, a Masonic emblem. And he either had it on him when he died or he didn't. But either way, it looks like the Mormons wanted it, at least Emma wanted it known, that Joseph Smith had fit kind of this Masonic legend of Hiram Abiff's death, going to his death with the Masonic jewel with the secret name of God carved onto it.
Hmm. Interesting.
And Nick Letursky has actually done some research on this. One of the arguments against Joseph Smith having it is it was actually sold to the church by Louis Bideman, who was Emma's husband's illegitimate son. And Nick Letursky's actually looked, and he's actually thinks he's figured out how it came into Louis Bideman's hands. While searching, and I don't have this data, but Nick has talked about it a little bit on public forums, he actually found out that after the Mormons left Nauvoo, that there was a lodge organized, a new Masonic lodge organized in Nauvoo, and that Louis Bideman's father, who was Emma's second husband, joined that lodge. And so what it looks like happened is that Emma, as kind of a commemoration of him joining a lodge, probably gave him that Masonic jewel, that Jupiter talisman, and then it was passed on to his son, who then later sold it to the church.
Okay, I can buy that.
Okay, so I think the argument that this is not something that Joseph Smith cared about or was not important to Joseph, I think is somewhat a bogus argument. I think it was very important to Joseph.
All right. Well, either way around, it's got very close connection. I mean, there's as much evidence for that as things we've canonized in the Doctrine of Covenants, you know. So, you know.
Yeah, I think so.
It's important either way, you know.
All right. So that kind of takes us through Joseph Smith's death. Let's go ahead and move on into the idea of, you know, throughout this podcast, I've talked quite a bit about how it seems like there's Masonic connections all over the place in Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
How does that stop? What happens that whole connection dies? And I thought we'd go ahead and discuss that.
Okay.
And then we'd move into Utah.
Oh, so are you going to argue that it starts to die before Salt Lake? Because I was just going to push you off and say, well, Brigham was big into masonry, and so was Heber and the Salt Lake Temple. And
I think it begins to show some wear before that.
Okay, let's hear it.
It doesn't disappear, but you can actually see the split. You know, where Brigham Young is kind of declaring we are our own masonry.
Because Zilpha and I, yesterday, were at the Daughters of Utah Pioneer Museum in Salt Lake. If you're going to hit one church site you in Salt Lake, for all of you out there, you got to go to the Daughters of Utah Pioneer Museum. And it is just chock full of Masonic stuff, just all over the. And if you look in, they have cases for Joseph Smith and for Brigham Young, and there is just so much masonry for those early, and they're unashamed about it. You know, they identify here's this Masonic pin and here's this Masonic whatever. Okay, so
did you see Joseph's cane?
Yeah, well, there's lots of canes. There's the. There's a couple of canes that had the hair in it. There's the cane that was made out of his coffin. And you got to know where these things are. They're not prominently displayed. You'd be reading along and you're like, oh my gosh.
Did you see a snake cane?
I saw it last time I was there, but I didn't see it this time. I'm not sure where they put it. Because it wasn't
in... Let's talk about that real quick.
It wasn't in the Joseph Smith case, but...
Okay. So let's talk about that one really quick, because that's really, really a fascinating Masonic artifact that no one realizes it is. It turns out, so if we go way, way back to New York, everybody, all the Mormons are using rods, especially the ones that were, you know, early on New York that were participating with Joseph Smith and the treasure seeking stuff. There's this idea of a rod being important, and you can get revelation from a rod, etc. Turns out that within Masonry, rods are very important. Okay. They're carried and used, not like the little rods, but like a big staff-like rod. And by the junior and senior deacon in the lodge, okay? And within the Royal Arch, you also receive as part of the... you use another Masonic rod, which is symbolic of Moses's rod. Okay. It's symbolic of Moses's rod. It's symbolic of Aaron's rod. And within Masonic legend, especially in Antiquities of Freemasonry, it actually has this long story that Adam himself, that Moses's rod actually was a branch from a tree that Adam took.
Okay.
From the tree of life. Okay. And so there's this history within Masonry of this idea of this, you know, Adam's rod becoming Moses's rod, becoming Aaron's rod, okay? And within the Royal Arch ritual, the rod is described as being carved into the head. You know, it's supposed to look like a snake. And one of Joseph Smith's canes fits the description perfectly. I mean, it's almost like Joseph Smith, you know, either carved it himself or had somebody carve it for him as symbolic that he believed he was, you know, a rightful heir to Royal Arch Masonry, and that he's recapitulating this in that. And so there's all these cool little rod things that are also connected with Masonry.
Well, I can tell you from the museum that the early church fathers were way into canes. And they would put locks of hair and other little gewgaws and doodads in and cut them out of all sorts of things. So I don't know where they got that tradition, but magic canes were very important in the early days.
Yeah. Okay. So the Masonic ties begin to fray actually within the New York or in the Nauvoo period. We talked about last time about Abraham Jonas makes Joseph Smith a Mason at sight. Well, it turns out that a couple of lodges are uncomfortable with this. And so they immediately go after Abraham Jonas and try to say, you know, you don't have the right to make a Mason on sight. What they're trying to do here is invalidate Joseph Smith's Masonic membership. Okay? And as the Mormon lodges begin to initiate people at breakneck speeds, the Grand Lodge and the local Masons get very worried because they realize they're going to very quickly be outnumbered. And so they end up revoking Nauvoo Lodge's charter. Okay? Now, this should tell you how important Masonry was to the Mormons and to Joseph Smith. Even though they lose their charter, they still run the lodge. You know, this is just one of those other things that says this is important.
Right.
And in fact, they build one of the most lavish Masonic lodges in the area. It's been rebuilt in Nauvoo, and it's now called the Cultural Hall, yeah. Even though it is not a cultural hall.
What a travesty.
It's a Masonic lodge.
Yes.
And when a few local Masons attend the opening ceremonies for the opening of this lodge, they're actually kicked out of Masonry by their local lodges, or at least disciplined. I don't think they're actually kicked out, but it's threatened that they're kicked out. And so even very early on, within 1842-43, there begins to be some friction between the Mormons and the Masonic lodges. And I think this kind of friction in many ways is what causes Brigham to think, you know, there's some conspiracy going on. And so I think the response to this is, well, they've told us that we can't have our own Masonry, or that we can't join their Masonry. Well, they must be spurious Masons, and we'll have our own Masonry. And so that's where you get kind of this divide. However, they do try to get their charters back. When they leave Nauvoo, most of them move over just across the river to Iowa.
Right.
And Iowa at this point didn't have a Grand Lodge of its own. And the Mormons actually actively participate in trying to get the Grand Lodge of Iowa formed so that they can actually restart Masonry legitimately in Iowa. And they actually help it along quite a bit, but in the end, they don't have the voting power to ensure that they can get the charters they need. And then when they leave Iowa, you know, they can't get any charters to open their own lodges.
Okay.
So even though there's friction, they're still trying to be good Masons. Now, when you get to Utah, things get kind of complicated. In 1860, the Brethren meet together. This is recorded in a meeting of 19 August 1860. There's a proposal put forth that, in fact, the Mormons should apply to one of the Grand Lodges, probably England, to get 5 charters to start lodges in Utah. Now, with 5 charters, they can actually start, if they have 5 charters, 5 lodges, that's enough to actually start your own Grand Lodge. And so what they're trying to do there, what's the discussion is going on there, is that they want to start the first Grand Lodge of Utah and have their own control over Masonry. Now, Brigham is a little skeptical, and he ends up postponing or, you know, just deciding that that wouldn't happen. In the meantime, you have the beginnings of the Utah Mormon War, and the troops come in to occupy the area. And while they're there, they form Rocky Mountain Lodge number 205. And so this is, again, one of these things where Brigham looks out and says, Masonry's come, but, you know, who's it come with? It's come with the army that's invading us. And it almost, you know, plays into Brigham's little bit paranoia that the Masons are out to get him. And this continues after that. In 1865, there's a lodge that is formed. And between 65, 66, 67, out to 71, there's a total of three Grand Lodges, or three Masonic Lodges that are formed in Utah. And for the most part, well, one of the restrictions on their charters, however, coming from other Grand Lodges in the area, is that because the Mormons are practicing polygamy and therefore breaking the law, that in fact a Mormon cannot be made a Mason. And so this gets actually enshrined in Masonic law within Utah.
So to be clear, the Masonic law forbids Mormons, not polygamists.
So the charter actually forbids Mormons because they're polygamists.
Okay. But a non-polygamist Mormon, would they be able to join the lodge?
So the feeling here is that because they could join the lodge, right, if they were Mormon and then get called to practice polygamy at any time.
Yeah.
And so the feeling here is, since the Masonic Lodge doesn't have any power to control that, they don't want to risk it. And so they just say Mormons can't join.
Okay. Makes sense to me.
Because for them, even if you're not practicing polygamy, you belong to a group that's breaking the law. And that's just unacceptable by, you know, Masonic dictates.
Yeah, that's understandable.
And so, in the meantime, in many ways, once however, they get three lodges, they form their first Grand Lodge. According to Masonic law, you can't have two Grand Lodges administering over the same geographical region. With the formation of the Grand Lodge in Utah, it becomes very clear that the Mormons themselves cannot form their own legitimate Masonic lodges.
Okay.
And so at that point, it really becomes, among the Mormons, impossible for them to create a lodge that they can control. Now, things also get even more hairy, though, because the Masonic lodges, for the most part, are all non-Mormons. The Masonic lodges in Utah actually campaign against polygamy. In fact, they open up their own halls to have printing presses brought in and anti-polygamy tracts printed in their establishments. As Brigham is trying to boycott all of the non-Mormon businesses, it turns out that many of those non-Mormon businesses are being run by local Masons.
Okay. Which is typical. I mean, a businessman would want those sort of connections. We talked about that before.
Yeah. But the other thing here is, if you're a non-Mormon in Utah at the time, this is the only way you're getting any socialization. Well,
that's true. And we also need to be clear that Brigham would call over the pulpit to boycott Gentile businesses and chide Mormons for patronizing Gentiles especially when there were Latter-day Saint enterprises. So, I mean, there was a unified effort, albeit not very effective, on the part of the church brethren to get people to not patronize the Gentiles.
Well, and it gets even more interesting than that. One thing that's common for Masonic businesses, okay, back in that day, it doesn't really exist today, is you would put out on a placard in front of your, you know, in the front window, square and compass. And this allows the other Masonic brothers to know, hey, this is a Masonic business, since one of the Masonic oaths is do not cheat another brother. And if they break that, you can actually bring them under Masonic charges and get them kicked out of the lodge. This provides an extra, in a day when the judicial systems were not that complicated, this allowed one to handle disputes over money in kind of a back channel way. Because of this, many Masons would like to do business with Masons. So they would put these placards outside to attract business and let them know, I'm a good upstanding Mason. I'm not, you know, you're going to get a square deal with me. Well, what does Brigham do? He borrows the Masonic symbol of the beehive. Right. He puts a all-seeing eye above it, and he puts these Masonic symbols outside of all of the Mormon businesses in many ways to kind of, you know, say, well, we have the true Masonry. You should just join us. And do you see what's going on there?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, the all-seeing eye is everywhere in Utah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a building I drive by every day in Lehi that's just still got it up there, an old CCMI building. The Nauvoo Brass Band had it on their flag. It's just everywhere.
Oh, yeah. It's if I'm remembering correctly, I think it's actually on the coins in Nauvoo that they're starting to print. No. Those are the coins in Utah. They start printing their own money.
Yes.
And the metal money, and it's got an all-seeing eye on one side with a crown symbol or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. There's an eye above or below the crown, and then the hand clasp on the backside, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if I'm remembering correctly, that's what it looks like.
I think so.
You know, there's all this Masonic imagery. It's clear that's what Joseph or Brigham and them are doing, and I think they're riffing on Joseph Smith. I think Joseph Smith actually thought of Masonry as something that would eventually flower into the kingdom. You know, and you know, this would be this loose consortium of people who would kind of vote together, but they didn't have to be Mormons. And so I think in many ways that idea of Masonry as part of the kingdom seeps into Brigham Young and is manifest in Utah, where they borrow all these symbols and associate them with the kingdom, which is now much more closely tied to the Mormons and a little more exclusionary of everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is, as you've said, is you went to the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers, these guys were still very proud of this Masonic heritage. They couldn't become Masons legitimately, but they were very proud of this stuff.
Right.
Now, the problem comes with, in many ways, with the next generation. Okay? If you actually look, you know, Brigham Young, they were very well aware that there's Masonic ties in the endowments. Brigham Young used to actually call the endowment Celestial Masonry.
Right.
This was, you know, they used to brag about the fact that, you know, the endowment was Masonically connected and they had the real Masonry. But when you have the next generation who now, because they can't start their own Masonic lodges, they've never been through the 3 degrees of Blue Lodge degrees, they stop understanding a lot of the symbolism and the meaning that Joseph Smith weaved into the endowment. And you lose a lot of perspective there. Now, the final blow, I think, comes in 1900, though. On April 12, 1900, the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve met. And one of the things that was discussed there was, well, one of the decision was made is the mind of the brethren that we should, that men could not have the approval or consent of the church in connecting themselves with secret societies. And those who already belong should be encouraged to withdraw as soon as they reasonably can. There was some discussion there if Masonry should be exempted from that. And the decision was no. And President Lorenzo Snow said that they were opposed to all secret societies and actually implemented as part of church policy that bishops and stake presidents could actually deny admission to the temple for ordinance work to any man who became a Mason. And this prohibition stayed in effect until, I believe, the 1980s. Although, as with all kind of Mormon things, Mormons, in some areas it was very tightly restricted. In other places that were a little bit further from Utah, stake presidents and bishops would overlook the idea if a man became a Mason.
Well, you know, when I grew up in the 70s and 80s, you know, in along the Wasatch Front, Masonry was openly and freely identified as a secret society of the ilk of the Book of Mormon and those from which you were banned via the temple recommend questions from being part of.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still some who hold that view today. I mean, that's clear.
Oh, and I think there's definitely a group that I've run into a few of them online. And I think that was largely allowed to grow. And I actually think it made its way almost kind of as into the temple endowment itself. You were telling me as we closed last time something that you had learned about Satan's temple apron that I'd love for you to talk a little bit about.
Yeah. I was chasing down a rumor, and our friend Mike Reed helped me out on this one. Somebody had suggested that of course, in the temple ceremony, Satan wears an apron. And the rumor was that it had a cross on it, as one of, he refers to the signs of his power. So, Mike and I did all the research that we could find to figure that out. And for the best that we can tell, now we're still looking for one of these satanic, black velvet aprons. And I'm sure they're worth a bundle if you can get your hands on one. I've never seen one, in real life outside the Salt Lake Temple. But from those in the know, It is black and usually velvet, and just the regular Masonic symbols are embroidered on there. So it's basically a normal Masonic apron, and I can't remember what all the symbols are on there. There's like a building, or I mean, you can probably.
So I've only seen I've wanted to get access to this as well. The closest I've come to is there was a Masonic or a Mormon endowment expose that was published in the Salt Lake Tribune, and it had a drawing.
You mean
of
from the 1900s or?
Yeah, 1900s. And it had the Masonic pillars of Jachim and Boaz on either side.
Right.
It was black with, it looked like silver or white embroidery. I wasn't, you know, it was hard to tell from the picture. Chain from one of them to a snake that was at the base of it. The other thing is, from what I've heard and what I've been able to pick up, the Satan is in the olden days was actually dressed as the master of a Masonic lodge.
Really?
Yeah, actually he was. He was, you know, had a top hat and all the usual accoutrements that the master of the lodge would wear. Now, one of the stories I actually really, really love is probably Mormonism's most outspoken anti-Mason was W.W. Phelps.
Okay.
Phelps, at the very beginning of the Morgan Affair, started a paper, and my mind's going blank, I think it was called the New Light Paper. And due to his paper, he actually caused a riot in the city where they stormed the Masonic Lodge and wrecked the lodge. From there, he moved, having destroyed Masonry in this small town of New York, he moved to one of the larger cities of New York, Canandaigua, which is just south. It's like 15 miles south of Palmyra. And he started a paper there. He was very, very heavily active in the anti-Masonic party. He actually ran on the anti-Masonic ticket as a lieutenant governor, didn't win. So he was probably Mormonism's biggest anti-Mason. Well, it shouldn't surprise you that Phelps' most favorite role to play in the temple was he loved to play Satan and get dressed up in, you know, this Masonic garb as Satan and make fun of his, you know, Masonic buddies. Now, in fact, one of the interesting things is, at Joseph Smith's death, he actually wrote a eulogy for Joseph Smith, in which it says Joseph Smith always hated Masonry and he was a devout anti-Mason his entire life. Well, the other brethren found out about what he had written in the eulogy and forbid him to print it or give his talk, you know, give his eulogy at the funeral, because they knew that, you know, Joseph Smith wasn't an anti-Mason. And they saw quite a bit of inflammatory language in Phelps's eulogy. So that only got printed, I think, recently, actually. I saw it in a BYU Studies article. Wow. So, you know, Phelps loved to play that role because he got to kind of his last kiss of, you know, anti-Masonic climax of his life in the temple. So.
Yeah, that's funny. Okay, so there is as long as we're talking about the temple and moving into today in Masonry, there are still some elements left over, and we were talking about the famous quote from Brigham Young that they read at the beginning of every temple ceremony.
Yes. Okay. So this is one of the most fascinating things I find. So Brigham Young at the dedication or the cornerstone laying ceremony for the Salt Lake Temple gave a talk. Okay. He actually gave two talks, one in the morning and one in the evening, if I'm remembering correctly. Now, one of the things you have to realize is the cornerstone laying ceremony is something that is very, very common in Masonry. And in fact, all cornerstone laying ceremonies, according to Masonic tradition, you always start at the northeast corner. Okay. Now, when Brigham Young sets up the cornerstone laying ceremony for the Salt Lake Temple, he actually places the different people. You know, he has the first presidency in one spot, the Quorum of the Twelve in another spot, the presiding bishopric in another spot. Each of them dedicates one of the stones. The interesting thing is, Joseph Smith had a specific pattern that he had done this for the Nauvoo and the Missouri Temple, and Brigham Young radically changed that. And so after the ceremony, he got all of these questions. And he also had to defend the fact that he placed the most prominent stone not in the northeast corner, like is normally Masonic, in Masonic tradition. He placed the most prominent stone in the southeast corner. And so his subsequent speech has all of these Masonic allusions and discussion of, you know, which stone is the most important that is going on there. He also, while he's there, gives the classic definition in Mormonism for the endowment. And he says, let me give you a definition of the endowment in brief. Your endowment is to receive all these ordinances in the house of the Lord, which are necessary for you after you have departed this life, to enable you to walk back to the presence of your Father, passing the sentinels who stand, or the angels who stand as sentinels, being able to give them the keywords, the signs, and tokens pertaining to the holy priesthood, and gain your eternal exaltation in spite of earth and hell. So he's giving this talk at a quasi-Masonic cornerstone laying where there's arguments going on about Masonic symbolism. What I wanted to know is that statement somewhat Masonic? And it turns out that he's using some Masonic language there. Here's a Masonic discourse from 1776. Further, let us take God's holy word for the only guide of our faith, and let justice, charity, and love and mercy be our distinguishing characteristics. Then may we reasonably hope, by an humble dependence on divine grace, to attain the celestial password for everlasting life, and so gain admittance into the lodge of our supreme grand master above, in whose blessed presence pleasures will most certainly flow forever and ever evermore. This is actually a quote from a newspaper in Albany in 1821. It says, the theological ladder which Jacob saw in his vision is the only means by which we can ascend into heaven, the three principal rounds of which are faith, hope, and charity. Mounting aloft on these rounds, may we all ascend by the benefit of the password, which is the Savior's righteousness, be admitted by the grand Tyler, death, into the inner temple above, and at the proper season, for our work is over, be permitted by the grand senior warden of the celestial to refresh our weary souls forever. So mote it be. Amen. From a Masonic, this is from a Masonic expose. So this is actually what's in the Masonic ritual itself. It says, the sprig of acacia is an emblematic of that immortal part of man which never dies. And when the cold winters of death shall be past, and the bright summer's morn of the resurrection appear, the Son of Righteousness shall descend, and send forth his angels to collect our ransom dust. Then, if we are found worthy, by his password, we shall enter into the celestial lodge above, where the supreme architect of the universe presides, where he shall see the king of the beauty of holiness, and with him enter into that endless eternity. Here's the quote from Antiquities of Freemasonry, the one that Joseph Smith is borrowing from heavily. And this is the conclusion that Masonry draws from all her illustrations. He who practices all the virtues thus recommended in faith, we rejoice in hope, be in perfect charity with all mankind, and finally receive a password into the grand lodge above, where peace, order, and harmony eternally preside. And this is the last one I'd like to read here, is actually from Hosea Ballyu, which we talked about way early on. Who was the Smith family's Universalist and Masonic pastor. He says, as we advance on the level of time to that distant country from which no man returns, let us take with us the password of faith, the grand sign of brotherly love, and pay due attention to the dictates of our guide, that we may faint not at the Jordan of death, and at last we may hear the gracious voice of our supreme grand master in heaven saying, let them enter to the enjoyments of the just man made perfect. So even the language of the classical definition of the endowment given by Brigham Young is echoing Masonic ritual and Masonic discussions of the time.
So for somebody like Brigham and the early guys in Salt Lake, is there evidence that they spent a lot of time playing around with Masonry, that they, you know, outside of all their church duties, did they keep doing the Masonic ceremonies and keep that up?
So according to Masonic law, the problem was, in order to do that, you have to have a organized Masonic lodge.
Well, I know that's the official thing.
And to do
thing,
that,
but
you have to have a charter. And as far as I've been able to tell, there's no evidence that they ever organized one or kept up with their Masonic stuff, because they couldn't do it. And I think what they really looked at was, well, we're doing all of this stuff already in the temple. That's our Masonry.
Oh, okay. But, I mean, Brigham Young had himself anointed king.
Kind of
you know, I don't think he would have any problem with just doing it. You know, I don't, you know, he thought he was, you know, the shit. So I think he would have done it if he wanted to. I was just wondering how he kept up, if he read, if they kept up doing the things or, you know, they were very well could have done in the temple, but that's pure speculation on my part.
I would love to find some data saying that that's happening. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't be too surprised.
Right.
But up until now, I really just have not been able to find any evidence that that's the case. I'd love to find it, though. So if anybody's listening to this and has some evidence.
Oh, can you imagine what's buried up in some people's attics still in Salt Lake City?
There's got to be stuff there.
Yeah. As long as Kate Carter doesn't burn it like she did everything else. Anyway, there's my dig at Kate Carter. So she actually died in 1976. Yeah. So sorry to Kate.
So should we deal with the? Is there any more questions that we want to deal with as far as how Masonry died?
Well, you know, I guess after the lodges, you know, sort of banned Mormons and Mormons turned against it. It was just like a slow death. Did it stay? You know, I noticed that, like in Provo, I think I mentioned this in another podcast, but in Provo, there's a lot more Masonic markings than in some of the other pioneer cemeteries. Were there enclaves where people kept it up, or do we have any evidence of that?
So there's an episode that I haven't studied in depth. And so I'm right at the edge of my memory here. There was a group of Mormons who kind of went rogue for a little while. Amongst them was the historian, if I remember correctly, by the name of Tulich. And he writes a lot about Masonry. He uses all this kind of like Masonic language in his History of Utah. My understanding is that group did, it seemed like they tried to become active in Masonry and do some things. I'm not exactly sure what that all entailed. It's one of the projects I still need to work on. But I do seem to remember something about that movement being centered in Provo. So that may be what you're seeing, kind of this statistical kind of bump in imagery in Provo. But I'd have to a little bit more research that probably needs to be done there.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let's talk about the state of affairs today. So was it 2 years ago or a year ago that the Grand Master Poobah, whatever you guys call him, in Salt Lake City, it was a Mormon for the first time in, well, maybe ever.
Mm-hmm. So let's back up a little bit. So the Utah Grand Lodge, as long as Mormons were practicing polygamy, they could basically say, well, you guys are polygamous, you can't be in our lodge. That was the easy argument. As we roll around to the 1900s, though, you start having Mormons who are never going to become polygamous. And so it's really, that's the first time the Grand Lodge of Utah starts saying, it has to start making a new rationale for excluding Mormons. Okay. And so all of a sudden they start going into like the Book of Moses, and they start saying, oh, look, here's this, these are anti-Masonic passages. And they start looking at the endowment and saying, ah, look, Mormons have stolen Masonic stuff. Now the truth is, if you actually go back to Nauvoo and look in the Grand Lodge records, there's this common epithet against Mormons that, you know, the Nauvoo Masons hated Joseph because he was revealing all their secrets. If you actually look through the Grand Lodge records, there's no indication that they cared. And you can actually see that in many ways as the Masons come to Utah as well. It's not until they kind of get some pressure to admit Mormons that they start looking at all of these things and saying, oh, well, they're clandestine. Their temple ceremony is clandestine Masonry. Therefore, that disqualifies them. And in fact, the 1920s, there's kind of a mini battle of words that goes on. I think it's the Grand Chaplain of Masonry has to come up with a brand new reason to exclude the Mormons from the Utah lodges. And in response to that, one of the first presidency members, Anthony W. Ivins, actually writes a book called, I think it's called Mormons and Masonry or something, which is kind of like this anti-Masonic, you know, kind of a justification of why Mormons are great and why Masons are jerks. But what ends up happening is the Grand Lodge of Utah is able to set up these new reasons. Now, however, through the 1900s, there's some problems. One of them is that the Grand Lodge of Utah, for years, is actually the smallest Grand Lodge in the United States, not surprisingly. The other thing that happens is you start getting Mormons who are outside of Utah that then become Masons. And I'm happy to look at my notes. Just generally, I think it's 1980. Yeah, 1980. There's a Mormon down in California who becomes a Mason and is raised to become the grand master, the head poobah of Masonry in California. Now, the problem becomes more and more that if they now come and visit Utah, even though they're legitimate Masons, they're not allowed entry into Utah Masonic lodges. And this starts pissing people off. And it just looks bad because this is incredibly un-Masonic. You do not treat a Masonic brother like this. And so the question reoccurs, should we change our policy? And in 1984, the prohibition against a Mormon becoming a Mason in Utah is repealed. And as you said, Glenn Cook becomes, just this last year, became the Grand Master, I think it was 2 years ago, became the first Mormon Mason in Utah to take the Grand Mastership. And he's tried, I think, in many ways to try to heal some of these rifts that's gone on. In 1984, when they repealed it, in the next printing of the Church Handbook of Instructions in 1989, the prohibition against joining any secret society, that stuff drops from the Church Handbook of Instructions. And so kind of a ceasefire happens between the two groups. Huh. And today, there's, for the most part, very little pushback on either side to becoming or not becoming a Mason. And so slowly you're beginning to have more and more Mormon Masons. And, you know, we're discussing things and we'd love to have some literature out there that discusses these things in a little bit more detail.
Well, and I've noticed that it's become almost hip among some apologists to become Masons. Carrie Schurz famously blogs about all of his Masonic endeavors these days. So I think the tide has shifted, and it almost reminds me, you know, Mormons have for a long time had sort of a hobbyist interest in Judaism. Mm-hmm. And it has that same sort of flavor, which there's a downside to it, because you know, people say whenever in American films, like, Americans always out-native the natives. So if you take an American and make them an Indian, they're going to be a better Indian than the Indians are. And there's always been this sort of, this is really catty of me to say, but among, like, Mormon scholars, you know, like, they understand Judaism better than Jews, sort of thing. And I'm afraid there's sort of that air that as these Mormons are discovering Masonry, it's sort of like they're, you know, out Masonic the Masons.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, I think as more and more Mormons, you know, I think there could be a tendency to that type of a trend. I think you're probably right. On the other hand, you know, for me, I joined because I liked the ritual. But what I really found is I like the brothers. You know, I have some good, you know, good friends in Elders Quorum. But what I found in the lodge is also kind of fulfills that need to have brothers that are outside of your own family. You know, that those bonds of fraternity. And I think, you know, anybody who goes to college and joins a fraternity senses this, you know, has this same type of, you know, kind of visceral reaction of being there for your brothers. And I think that's something that we're in large part missing from our culture. You know, as the other thing I like about it is, while I was born into Mormonism, I made a choice to become a Mason, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I make a choice every day to continue to be a Mormon, so it's not like that's not a choice as well, but I enjoy it. It's there for the most part. Masons are very good people, and it's fun to have dinner with the guys. So,
yeah, and I think there's a sad element. Of course, like all the other fraternal lodges in the United States, Masonry is dying.
There's some truth there
in terms of numbers and the aging and to be honest, I think Mormonism and basically all the other organized religions are following close on their heels, and I think there's sort of a sadness to that. You know, there's something to be had in the cultural spirit of these grandiose things and those things that came up with in the 1700s and those things that Joseph Smith was riffing on and these vibrant living ideas that people could really like sink their teeth in, and that excitement of yeah. the heavens being open and here you are participating in something and moving up and gaining new knowledge. And you know, I can see the beauty and the grace of that.
Well, and one of the things that I like, so a large part of the ritual is, well, first of all, I think as humans, I don't think everyone's hardwired like this, but I think a large number of people are kind of hardwired to learn through ritual. And especially the Masonic ritual, you know, has been tweaked and edited, and I think it has kind of universal appeal and speaks to one on a kind of visceral level. One of the things I love is part of the ritual is kind of an allegorical discussion of what it means to move from being a youth to a man to someone who's mature and older. The three stages of this are the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, and the master mason. And I think there's some beautiful symbolism there. You know, as an entered apprentice, you sit in the quarries and you do exactly what you're told, and you don't ask questions, and you just kind of do what you're supposed to do. As a fellow craft, you take those stones that are rough, and you make sure they're perfectly square. And I find that this is true in my own life. At a certain point, and the other thing that comes along with the fellow craft degree is you begin studying the seven sciences. You know, and this is the age that as we reach when we move out of youth and into manhood, where we take a strict rational approach to everything in the world. We want everything to be scientific. We want everything to be perfect, you know, perfectly fit. But at the same time, just because you can do that doesn't mean that you're a master mason who can take those stones and build something new, build something glorious, build something that's more than just stones. And as you grow up and you start realizing that, I think that's another stage in life where you start realizing that you need to create something. Something that's new, something that's novel, something that's you. And not only that, but you take charge of your own life. And you stop letting the overseers tell you how many stones to make. You design your own life. And then you move up to, you know, a higher level where you're a grandmaster. Where not only are you creating your own life, but you're trying to lead others to create their own lives and control their own lives. And I think there's some deep, deep symbolism there. And I think that's what Joseph Smith in many ways was trying to kind of riff off when he talks about the difference between somebody who's telestial, someone who's terrestrial, and someone who's celestial. And so for me, that's one of the reasons why the temple ceremony is, you know, it's the temple ceremony itself, at least in my own mind, because of what I've experienced with the Masonic elements, is this idea of growing up. And you have to make your own life. You have to decide what is true, what is not true. and go with it.
Yeah, I like that. And you know, Joseph Smith was a magpie, and I mean that in the nicest way. You know, he recognized things and symbols and learning from around him, and tried to incorporate it all. And it's sort of a shame we've moved away from that.
Yeah.
Well, as a follow up, I have two 19th century copies, one of Steinhaus's book and the other of Beadle's Mysteries and Crimes of Mormonism. On page 487 in Mysteries and Crimes of Mormonism, there's five panels that show scenes from the endowment. And so let's see, this is from, what year was this published? 1870. And in the top right-hand panel, there's a picture of from the endowment ceremony of Adam and Eve being cast out of the Garden of Eden. And there is Satan cowering on the ground. Now, he's wearing a little hat, kind of like Genghis Khan is always depicted of wearing, like with a little onion top and the fur around it.
Oh, how weird.
And he's wearing it, what looks like it's a wood cut. So it's, you know, all black and white, but he's wearing some kind of tunic. It has no discernible robe. The figure playing God is wearing what looks like a miniature Pope hat, and like a tunic sort of thing, sort of like pages wore who played the trumpet for the king. You know, that goes from the shoulders down to about mid knee over the top of a robe. And then there is a scene. Oath to avenge the death of Joseph, and again the presider is wearing a little Pope hat, and he's wearing white robes. I don't know how accurate these drawings are, but I think that's interesting. So the only picture I can find,
the Pope hat is similar to some stuff that Bennett drew.
It could be. And this book has one of the earliest transcripts of the endowment. This Mysteries and Crimes of Mormonism. I think it's been reprinted. You can get a copy of it today.
Okay.
But you know, it's questionable how accurate it is. There's some things that seem accurate. It does say that the role of Satan was portrayed by W.W. Phelps. So you,
yay, I got
you
that right.
And Life and the Mysteries and Crimes of Mormonism are in agreement on that. So,
you know, I've mentioned at the beginning that I'm still a practicing Mormon. And
yes.
You know, the truth is, many of these things were not what I expected when I began studying this stuff. But I think every person that comes to it must judge it for themselves. I've actually kind of, in many ways, gained a respect for Joseph. Joseph wasn't perfect, but as I've been actually carefully going through what he did, I personally, from what I'm seeing Joseph Smith less as a, almost like Joseph Smith actually has a plan of what he wants to build up. And what I've learned is, in many ways, Joseph has become more human, but he's become someone that I find much more interesting as a person and as a prophet. I guess what I'd like to urge, you know, any believing members is don't be afraid of the truth.
Hmm.
You know, it'll lead you where it leads you. As Joseph Smith taught in Nauvoo, he taught that one of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is truth. And I'd like to urge members just to go after the truth, because in the end, that's what matters. And I think a lot of people will be surprised that many of the things that they usually I think in many, at least for me, what I found is more interesting and in many ways more beautiful. Seeing these kind of universal principles, looking at what you know, looking at Joseph Smith's universalist background, are some beautiful things that I think have slowly over time died in Mormonism. And I love those kind of universalistic ideas. I love the ideas of you know, the ritual and what these things mean. And, you know, so I'd encourage both those who are just interested in it and, you know, are no longer Mormons to go ahead and study this stuff. It's really cool. And those that are still Mormons, I'd say, you know, don't be afraid. Obviously, Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, and all these guys were Mormons. They knew the connections. It didn't bother them. It shouldn't bother us either. And I think it helps us understand more our own past as well.
Yeah, well, amen to that. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think truth and the pursuit of truth is messy.
Yes.
And if you've got it in you, embrace it. And, you know, there's nothing, if the church is true or if it's marginally true or if it's kind of true, there's nothing to be afraid of. And, go out there and eat it up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm almost sad to say goodbye. It's been a,
it's been a lot of fun.
It's been a lot of fun. And I really do encourage people to head over to the boards. There's been a lot of great side discussion on all three podcasts. I'm sure they'll be on this one and see some of the things there. And you've been great to monitor when people posted stuff and get right on top of answering that. So I appreciate that.
I'd really like to encourage everybody to go over there. There's some very fascinating discussions. Let me kind of pimp that a little bit. There's actually a discussion there on Joseph Smith's kind of dispensationalism and how that ties in with Mormonism. There was a discussion over there about the Jupiter Talisman where there was actually, I actually pulled out some quotes discussing that. There's that to look over there. There was kind of a short but a very interesting discussion on the kingdom and Joseph Smith's connection with that to Freemasonry. There's a number of very interesting posts over there, and I will continue to monitor the boards and respond and continue to respond to anybody's questions for this last podcast. So if there's anything that you wanted to ask and or were hoping would be discussed, feel free to go over there. There's even a short discussion on Pratt's murder and some potential Masonic connections with that. So,
oh, wow.
Please go look on the boards. There's some interesting conversations that have gone on.
Excellent. All right. And as a reminder, our first Mormon Expression Live lecture will be on Wednesday, September 7th, 2011 at 7 p.m. in the Salt Lake City Library downtown. Will Bagley will be presenting his lecture, The Sharpest Thorn, Life on the Borderlands of the Mormon West. It is free of charge, and you can meet cool people like Zilpha, who should be there, and Will Bagley, who's a cool cat in and of himself. And then reminder, our cruise is in January. Head over to Mormon Expression, follow the link up in the top right-hand corner, and you can get connected to our travel agent. All right. Well, George, we're going to have you back on for another discussion at some point. You've been a real treat.
And so have you. And I appreciate you giving some time and allowing us to give some information that's a little inaccessible. And I hope everybody's enjoyed themselves. I know I sure have.
Great. Thanks.
So mote it be.